It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
This is episode 708 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 13th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster, a date in history for one of my all-time favorite WWE shows. Which one is that? Well, you'll have to wait until the history segment to find out. I got news on Kenny Omega defending the Impact World title on pay-per-view last night, where a moose got screwed by a couple of bucks. Triple H gets a little prickly on the pre-takeover conference call. He went all Prickly Pete on us this week. Takeover in your house is tonight. I've got predictions for that. Dynamite aired on Friday, so I've got a full review of that as well. And thoughts on the last of the A&E biographies on Bret the Hitman Hart. A loaded show. And I thank you for your support each and every week. Now listen up, if you are an Amazon Prime member and you sign up for a trial of Amazon Music with our link, you get 4 months free. But only if you sign up between now and June 22nd, which is coming up pretty quick. 4 months of Amazon Music for free. Just use our link, getamazonmusic.com/solomonster. Even if you're not a Prime member, you can still try it out for free, but 4 is better than 3. This won't last long, so get on that. GetAmazonMusic.com/Solomonster. And if you want to make a PayPal donation to support the show, entirely voluntary, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out like these fine folks here this week. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar, who I always see popping in the chats during the live streams on YouTube. Hopefully he'll be joining us tonight. Mean Matt Forbush, who says he simply cannot start his week without hearing the show. So thank you for that, Matt. That means a lot. John Loose Cannon Lopez, West Coast James Herrera, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Evil Dose, Jeff Lippman, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the 90s Vampire, Eddie Valens, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soet, Ostentatious Alan Carter, who is taking some well-deserved days off. He celebrated a birthday on Friday, and I hope it kicked all kinds of ass. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, I Run These Streets, Ivan Parra, Michael Maximum Pain Palkowski, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell. I got it right this time, I hope. Apparently I butchered his first name the first time. He blames his mother for that, but don't blame your mom. Your mom, I'm sure, gave you that name with love. But thank you for the support. The Goddess of Justice, Samantha Turner, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, and a shout out to gorgeous Jessica Green, who celebrated a birthday yesterday. Happy birthday. I won't sing How Old Are You Now, because you never ask a lady how old she is. Not unless you want to get smacked. Although I guess some people might like that. But anyway, Jessica, I hope you had a great birthday. And belt fan Brent Banner, this week on the How Did We Even Get Here podcast in the wake of the Naomi Osaka controversy, Brent and Trey argue over the importance or unimportance of post-game press conferences. Also, are men mind readers and other relationship questions answered? All that, plus the FU of the week, good vibes only, and more. You can find them on 13 different platforms now. Head over to your favorite one and search How Did We Even Get Here? Or you can find them on YouTube directly at tinyurl.com/gethere tube. And one thing I wanted to mention here, because I only opened it up a few days ago, very excited about this, and this was something that had been requested for a long time. If you are a Sound Off channel member on YouTube, so we have two membership tiers for those who want to become a channel member on YouTube. You can become a Sound Off Superstar, or you can become a Sound Off Legend, which also gives you access to the lost episodes of the show that are going up each week. But regardless of which tier you are on, if you are a channel member, you now have access to the official Sound Off Discord. We now have a Discord server that is open. You can find the post under the community tab on YouTube. And don't just click the Discord link to join. Be sure to leave a comment with your Discord name, your handle, so I know who it's coming from. But you can now, if you are a YouTube member, you can now join the Sound Off Discord. Right now we're keeping it limited only to YouTube members. A little private Discord there. I'm still getting my feet wet when it comes to Discord anyway, so I'm kind of learning as I go here. And I thought, you know, while I learn as I go, this would be a nice little perk to offer to the YouTube community. So if you are going to be around during Takeover in Your House, I suggest you hang out in the chat later tonight. And I might even try to patch through some Discord calls. You never know. So make sure your audio is working and you got a mic hooked up, and we might try to get that going. But again, the people who have joined the Discord so far, welcome. And if you want to become a Sound Off channel member on YouTube, you too will have access to the new Discord. So I wanted to make sure I mentioned that here up front. 3 years ago, I covered the incident in Mexico where a wrestler named Angel o Demonio, Angel or Demon, he was no angel on that night, threw a 20-pound cinder block at his opponent's head from inside the ring to the floor. Cuervo was his opponent. He had his back turned, struck him right in the head, and nearly killed him. He suffered a skull fracture. He ended up with a blood clot in his brain. They were having a casket match, and he claimed he did it because Cuervo had hit him with some stiff chair shots during the match, and that was his receipt, I guess. There's a word for what he did. Actually, well, there's two. There's two words for what he did. It's called attempted murder. If you throw a cinder block at someone's head full force like that, you don't belong in a ring. You belong behind bars. And yet, he still got bookings after that. Well, he did. Anyway, he's dead now. He died this week from COVID-19, 57 years old. Demonio was sick at home for about a week, finally took himself to the hospital, ended up on a ventilator, and died. So that is the follow-up to that story. I saw his name and I said, oh, that name sounds familiar, and then I remembered the story from a few years ago. So there's your follow-up. One of the most disturbing things still that I have ever seen in wrestling. There were two big title changes this week, and they were the two best matches all week that I saw. First, New Japan surprised me at their Dominion show. They put the IWGP World Heavyweight title on Shingo Takagi. I figured they would go back to Okada as their security blanket, especially during these lean times for the company. Shingo beat Okada in an excellent match to win the championship, his first IWGP World title, which was vacated due to Will Ospreay's neck injury. Shingo called out Kota Ibushi after the match, who accepted his challenge on a date yet to be announced. So those two are going to be matched up at some point in the next month or two. And Mako Satomura, maybe the best women's wrestler in the world today, even at age 41, and probably the most respected, beat Kaylee Ray to win the NXT UK Women's Championship in an excellent match, ending Kaylee Ray's reign as champion at 649 days. It may be time to move her over to the main NXT brand, give her a whole batch of new women to work with. For Satomura, you know, I was chatting with some of our YouTube members in the Discord chat that I just mentioned, and I said this the other day. I said, I would love to see Satomura just one time. Doesn't have to be a program. Nobody has to shift brands. Doesn't even have to be for a championship. But just one time, I'd like to see Meiko Satomura in the ring for a big match against Sasha Banks. And I know they both have a great amount of respect for each other. When Sasha took her little sabbatical a couple of years ago and disappeared, she had gone, I think, to Japan for a few days to actually train with Satomura. And Satomura has spoken highly of her as well. You put those two women in the ring together for a big match, that would be pretty amazing stuff. So I just put that out there into the atmosphere. Whatever happens, happens. But that is a match that I would love to see. Now, tonight is NXT TakeOver In Your House. Not the strongest TakeOver card on paper, but it is TakeOver, so you know it's going to be a good show. Todd Pettengill is back to host. They even had Michael Hayes revive his old Doc Hendricks persona on NXT Tuesday night to run down the card like those old Slam Jam updates he used to do. I do miss those card rundowns that WWE used to do for their pay-per-views. I know they don't think it's a good use of their TV time these days, but I disagree. I think it's a good way to get people hyped up and pumped up for the shows if you have the right person doing them. Hayes looked completely ridiculous wearing that hat. That hat has got to go. But, I mean, look, I could have just ended that sentence with Hayes looked ridiculous. I really didn't even have to mention anything about a hat. I mean, it's Michael Hayes that we're talking about here. But I enjoyed it. And I'm hoping that we get him and Todd Pettengill in the same place together tonight. I used to watch those two on Action Zone together every Sunday, another show that's not on Peacock. But last year, Todd did all of his stuff from his home studio during COVID. There was an NXT press conference that they had the other day, and he was there in person. So maybe we will have a little Todd Pettengill, Doc Hendricks reunion tonight. Io Shirai is not on the card, but she did make her return on Tuesday night. Poppy was on the show to promote her new album, and she gave Dexter Lumis a hug after he presented her with a drawing that he did. And Indy Hartwell, of course, walked in on them just at that moment, and she ran away heartbroken and devastated. This led to Candice LeRae cutting a promo on Poppy, who said that she doesn't wrestle, but she knows someone who does, and out came Io Shirai, who, last we saw her, she lost the women's title to Raquel Gonzalez, and then she had a confrontation with Frankie Monet. She had nothing to do with Candice LeRae. So I guess she just so happened to be there to help Poppy, but at least Triple H was able to rescue her from a main roster call-up for the time being. So that's the good news about seeing Io Shirai back on NXT television. She is spared, for now, the probably inevitable call-up to Raw and SmackDown. I know Asuka has had quite a bit of success over the year. Not all the time, but, you know, I would call overall Asuka a main roster success story for all of the success that she has had. Could that be Io Shirai? Could be. Could be, but there's a lot of evidence to point that that might not be such a good idea. So if she's going to stick around NXT for a little while longer, good. Good. Tonight we have Xia Li against Mercedes Martinez. 4 years after Martinez defeated Li in the first round of the very first Mae Young Classic, Xia Li has not forgotten, which is why she started targeting Martinez. WrestleVotes had tweeted this week that Eva Marie, who will be on Raw tomorrow night, is expected to have some muscle as her backup. And the two names that they've heard discussed for the role are Mercedes Martinez or Piper Niven from NXT UK. I already had Xia Li down in my predictions for the win here. I mean, my mind hasn't changed on that. I'm picking Xia Li to win. But it makes sense. You know, Martinez loses here and then debuts on Raw the next night as backup for Eva Marie. I think she would work much better in the role than Piper Niven would. And before people turn on the idea of pairing off Mercedes with Eva Marie, just remember, it cannot be any worse than Retribution. This is a woman who dodged a huge bullet with that Retribution thing on the main roster. But whatever you think of Eva Marie, you know she's going to be pushed in whatever role that she is in. So pairing off Mercedes Martinez with Eva Marie would not be the worst thing in the world. In a match that was added after this week's NXT show, North American champion Bronson Reed teams with the NXT Tag Team Champions MSK, or MISC. Still don't know what MSK stands for. Take on Santos Escobar, Joaquin Wilde, and Raul Mendoza of Legado del Fantasma. Winner take all. So both the tag team titles and the North American title will be on the line. So they're borrowing a page from an old In Your House show, right? The triple header match in September of 95 with Diesel and Shawn Michaels winning all the gold. I'm not a fan of throwing this on the show like this. They could have done Escobar one-on-one with Reed for the North American title, but it just feels like they wanted a tag team match on the show. But they looked at the card and thought, well, it would bloat the card too much, so let's just throw them all in a match together. That's what this feels like to me. I don't see them taking the title of Reed so soon after he won it, so I predict the baby faces to go over here. We've got LA Knight taking on Cameron Grimes in a ladder match to crown a new $1 million champion. There it is. I figured it had to be coming. That'll sell some more replica belts, that's for sure. On Tuesday, they promoted that Ted DiBiase would be there to make a priceless announcement of some kind. He brought Grimes and Knight out to the ring and said that it was time for them to climb the ladder of success. And down from the ceiling, they lowered a gold-painted ladder. DiBiase ordered his guards, I guess they were, to bring a briefcase into the ring, and inside the briefcase was the old $1 million belt, which has not been seen on television in over a decade. His son was the last one to hold that championship, and I can only hope whichever one of these guys wins it has better luck with it than he did. But Cameron Grimes, he cut this great, like, almost babyface-esque promo. And in the members-only Q&A that I recorded for my YouTube members a couple of weeks ago, I was asked about who on the main WWE roster could I see catching fire and getting over the way that Daniel Bryan did. Is there anybody that I see who can get over in the way that Daniel Bryan did in 2013 into 2014? And I said that I don't see anybody on the main roster right now who is going to get over or could. There's no evidence of anybody on the main roster that I see who could get over the way that he did. But I said that if there's one person who I could see the fans eventually getting behind like that as the scrappy underdog, it's not anybody from the main roster. It's from NXT. And that person is Cameron Grimes. And I believe that. I think he has that potential. But it's also why I think he's losing this match, and LA Knight will be your new $1 million champion. Grimes shouldn't win this. I don't think Cameron Grimes should win this match. I think that this could be the start of a babyface run for him. And Knight, I mean, he would just fit like a glove with that belt. So I've got LA Knight going over. Ember Moon challenges Raquel Gonzalez for her NXT Women's Championship. Ember had a match with Dakota Kai on Tuesday and had the match won until Gonzalez interfered for the DQ. Moon did get to stand tall after the match. I hope she savors it because it is the only win that she is going to be getting against Raquel Gonzalez. Raquel will retain her title tonight. There is no chance that Ember wins that belt back. And Karrion Kross defends the NXT Championship in a fatal five-way match against Adam Cole, Johnny Gargano, Pete Dunne, and Kyle O'Reilly. You know, it's weird because O'Reilly is really the only solid babyface in this match. With Kross, it's been more shades of gray recently. But we had the parade of challengers out to cut promos on Kross at the end of Tuesday's show. First it was Kyle, then it was Gargano, Pete Dunne, finally Adam Cole. He appeared on the video screen from an undisclosed location. A brawl broke out in the ring with the other four until Kross stood tall, only for Adam Cole to show up, and he super kicked him from behind. He put him out with the last shot to the back of the head, and Cole picked up the NXT title, held it high in the air as the show ended. I just don't see anybody in this match worth switching the title to unless Cross is getting called up. And I don't think he is yet, so I'm picking Karrion Kross to retain. Kyle O'Reilly is very good. He's very talented. I don't see him at that level yet. I don't see him as NXT champion. Pete Dunne could get there. It just doesn't feel like the right time. If they were to put the belt on him and build around him as this really kind of evil heel, I feel like I could get behind that. But I don't know. The timing just doesn't feel right for that. I don't see Gargano taking it. Cole, you know, I don't know. I just don't see that what's accomplished by taking it off Cross just to put it back on Adam Cole. So, yeah, I mean, I think Cross is going to retain. I'm sure the action will be good. But I'm not a fan of shoehorning all five guys into one match like that. I will be live on YouTube after tonight's show for a full recap. So you get two podcasts in one day. Same next Sunday, too. After Hell in a Cell. Actually, you're going to get three podcasts because as soon as I'm done here, I'm going to be recording my final Dark Side of the Ring review on the Dynamite Kid till the season resumes in September. This is the last episode for now. So you're going to get three shows today. I hope you have cleared your calendar and made time. Now let's talk about Triple H, who did his usual pre-takeover media conference call this week. Triple H showed his ass a bit on that call. He got snippy after Dave Meltzer asked a question about the misuse of NXT talents on Raw and SmackDown, and if moving up to the main roster has lost some of its excitement and lost some of its luster. To which Triple H talked about how, you know, sometimes the talent just doesn't fit. Or they hit their peak before they come to WWE. And not even saying that that's incorrect. In some cases, that may well be true. But it just felt like such a cop-out answer to hear him spit that out. He blamed the fans for ruining their own enjoyment at times because they're more worried about where things are going than enjoying the ride. Which, again, there is an element of truth to that. Sometimes we are all guilty of that from time to time. But you know why that happens? Because we are excited to see some of these men and women thriving and doing well in NXT and getting over. We find them entertaining, only to be stifled once they hit Raw or SmackDown. And it more often than not has nothing to do with them not being a good fit or peaking too early. It has to do with bad creative. Or one person not believing in them. One person not understanding the character. I don't get it. But of course, he can't say that. Which is why I actually have sympathy for him. I do. I have sympathy for Triple H. Triple H is in a tough spot. He can either tell the truth, and what he knows to be the truth, because there is no way that he is not fighting to keep some of these people like Adam Cole on NXT because he knows they're fucked if they hit the main shows. No way that's not going on. So he can tell the truth, or he can speak ill of the old man, and that's his boss. That's his family. That's his father-in-law. He's not going to do that. But he's not a dumb person. He knows what the deal is. So I don't expect him to say the quiet part out loud. The part that I will take him to task for is going with the tired, just watch it or don't. He threw that out there as well with the fans. Just watch it or don't. Hey, Paul, guess what? A lot of people, they don't watch anymore. They took your advice years ago. In that Raw promo about my friend Mark. I'm gonna stop watching. Well, guess what? Mark didn't. Mark is probably still watching. I'm Mark. You're Mark, right? Most of the people listening to this are. But everybody else did. They were averaging about 4.5 million viewers back then. Now they're under 2 million every week. So a lot of those people, they did stop watching. So I wouldn't be throwing that line out there anymore. He was also asked about sending talent to the NWA for the all-women's pay-per-view that was announced this week for August 28th that Mickie James is producing for them. Something that she wanted to do for WWE, but they weren't interested, and she was told that the first Evolution show didn't do well, and let's be honest here. The main reason they even did that Evolution show in the first place was public relations. They got a ton of backlash for going to Saudi Arabia without the women because the women at the time were not welcome there. They were not going to be allowed to perform. And they didn't. 5 days after that Evolution pay-per-view, the men were on a plane to Riyadh for Crown Jewel. Evolution was their attempt to calm things down. That is all it was. Were it not for that, I honestly don't believe there would have been an Evolution show. Not that point, maybe later on. But Mickey had made a remark this week about wanting the best female talent in the world to appear on their pay-per-view, regardless of contractual status. And Triple H had this to say in response. He didn't mention Mickey by name, but it was obvious this is what he was referring to. He says, "I do think it's funny when people go, 'I want the best in the world, regardless of contractual status.' What? I'm sorry, but from a business person's standpoint, then why do we have contractual status? If you want to wrestle the best women in the world, come to WWE." And, you know, he was talking about how everybody wants to come to WWE, which is bullshit. We already know that's not true. But, you know, come to WWE, he says. Yes, come to WWE, where you too can run away from a fucking doll. Come to WWE. Look, I don't have an issue with him putting over his own talent. When you are in the position that he is in, that's what you do. You put over your talent, you put over your own brand, you speak highly of them. The NXT women's division is one of the best in the world right now. He's absolutely right about that. But there is plenty of quality female talent all over the world. Thunder Rosa said it best in a tweet this week. She said, "The best female wrestlers are not located in any one company, not even in any one country. They are spread over many companies and many countries. Talented women across the globe." And she's right. But he was putting his own company over. I don't fault him for that. And he is right about contractual status too. I would love for them to send women to appear on the NWA show. I think that'd be very cool. I like it when companies work together. We're seeing a lot of that now, just not with WWE. But we're seeing a lot of that now. But the idea that women should show up regardless of contractual status... I mean, I know there's an independent contractor joke in there somewhere, but a contract is a contract. Billy Corgan still has to say yes when Tony Khan wants to use Thunder Rosa on his show. I don't think Billy Corgan would like it very much if Tony Khan just started booking Thunder Rosa directly behind his back whenever he wanted to. Because she has a contract with the NWA. So that was a pretty dumb thing, I think, for Mickey to say. Some more news and notes. Per the Matt Men podcast, WWE is looking at doing another draft after SummerSlam. Right now, the dates penciled in are Raw on August 30th and SmackDown on September 3rd. Considering how thin things feel roster-wise on the main brands right now, as far as, you know, top baby faces and in the women's divisions, I don't think they have a choice this time but to call up some names from NXT. You know, there might have been one or two drafts years ago where NXT had involvement, but some of the more recent ones, NXT was not formally involved or part of the draft. I really don't think they have a choice this time. They're going to have to call up some new faces. And the idea for SummerSlam this year is said to be for the show to be bigger than WrestleMania. WrestleVotes tweeted after speaking to a few sources on the topic, "I've learned that WWE is 100% attempting to make SummerSlam this year's WrestleMania. All resources will be tapped into," is how it was explained to me. So there it is. We go from WrestleMania Backlash to WrestleMania SummerSlam coming up this August. By the way, based on what is shown on the Ticketmaster website, WWE is only setting Allegiant Stadium up for a little over half capacity. So that's somewhere in the 30 to 40,000 seat range for SummerSlam, which could change. But right now, that's all they're allotting for, which is still a lot of people if they can fill it. If they can get 40,000 people in there, that's still 40,000 people. But they clearly do not expect to fill the entire stadium if that's all that they're opening up. So anybody expecting a packed house, 60, 70,000 people for SummerSlam right now, probably not going to happen. But, you know, a lot of talk about SummerSlam coming up August 21st. And they do want to make the show out to be a big deal. Even if they don't have full capacity, they're going to have more people in the building than they did for either night of WrestleMania. This will be their biggest show since the start of the pandemic. And here's how I would map out, not the entire card, but the top of the card, the key matches on the card. Obviously, you hear a lot about Roman Reigns, John Cena. Is that going to be the match? It should be. Because that is, outside of The Rock, who I'll get to in a second, the biggest possible match I think you could do right now with Roman Reigns. So the main event should be Roman Reigns defending the Universal Championship against John Cena. John Cena coming back for one big match, you know, at least one big match would be, you know, a big deal. And Universal title on the line, which creates the story of Cena challenging for what would be title number 17. Just a natural story. Match has only been done one time before. Roman Reigns got the win there, but very different dynamic when you had two baby faces in the ring together. So there's the big match, right? The other big match, and this does not sound as likely, but it's still a match that I would do everything in my power to try to put together. You lure back Brock Lesnar for a match with Bobby Lashley for the WWE Championship. Doesn't even have to be for a championship, but it should probably be for the WWE Championship. Obviously, it's a match Lashley wants. He's talked about it in interviews for years. It's a match that has never been done before. Lashley has now been built up to a level where he is a champion on the level of what Lesnar was at one time in the company. I'm not saying he's as big of a star as Brock was, but Lashley was always underneath. He was intercontinental U.S. level. Now he is the WWE champion. Now he is pushed as one of the biggest stars on Monday Night Raw. He has finally reached that level. After all the years that he has spent in this company, he's finally there, getting the biggest push of his life. If ever there was a time to do this match, now is that time. And that would be a huge double main event. Edge. Last we saw him, he was acting very heelish. I don't think that necessarily means when he comes back that he's going to be a heel. I would bring him back to SmackDown and pair him up with Seth Rollins for a match at SummerSlam. Sasha Banks challenging Bianca Belair for the SmackDown Women's title in a WrestleMania rematch is a natural, unless they want to add Bayley to make it a triple threat. You know, Bayley was left off the WrestleMania card this year. They put her in a throwaway segment with the Bella Twins. So she deserves something bigger on this show. If not a triple threat, then why not a match against Becky Lynch? I was going to say Becky comes back and challenges Rhea for the Raw Women's title that she technically never lost. But the SmackDown Women's division is just so weak right now. And with Rollins on SmackDown, I don't think they would want to put him and Becky on separate brands and split them up like that. So you could load up that first SmackDown back in front of fans on July 16th, bring Becky back that night, build to a match with Bayley at SummerSlam, and you can keep Sasha against Bianca one-on-one. I'm cool with that. That works for me. You get two matches out of it instead of one. You got Randy Orton and Matt Riddle. Clearly, they are on their way to the Raw Tag Team titles. I would hold off until SummerSlam and have them challenge AJ Styles and Omos on that show for the belts. And then you do the Usos against Rey and Dominic Mysterio for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. Those are the key matches that I would book for SummerSlam. Now, Drew McIntyre is the odd man out in that scenario if he doesn't go into the show as the WWE champion. Which he very well might. But if not, You know, he did an interview just in the past week or so where he talked about wanting to wrestle Walter. He said, we're going to make that match happen. It's just a matter of, not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. SummerSlam is probably too soon for that to happen. The problem is, I don't want Walter anywhere near Raw or SmackDown under Vince McMahon's thumb. I mean, we already saw what happened in the one Survivor Series match that Walter was in, right? He was the first one out 2 or 3 minutes into the match. I look at a guy like Walter, and I've watched his work, and I like his work, and I know what he's about. And he, in a lot of ways, he's kind of a throwback. But I can't help but look at Walter and think, if I were Vince McMahon looking at Walter, would he see Walter the same way? I don't believe he would. And that scares the shit out of me. So that's my problem with the idea here. Were it not for that fact, yeah, hey, it would be a great match to do, Walter against Drew McIntyre. But for August, maybe it's a different NXT call-up. Maybe it's somebody else from NXT who gets called up and works with Drew. But there you go. That's my early SummerSlam card. So you can chime in with your thoughts on what you think about that. Now, Andrew Zarian is also reporting that Survivor Series is going to be hosted in Brooklyn this year. And internally, the hope is that they can get Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, to make an appearance on the show. That could be where they shoot some kind of angle that leads to Rock against Roman Reigns or WrestleMania next year in Dallas. You know, with Rock, it always boils down to his movie schedule or insurance concerns if he wrestles a match. Because remember, the last big WrestleMania match that Rock had, I'm not counting the 6-second match he had with Eric Rowan, which also was in Dallas, actually. It was against John Cena. It was the second match against Cena. And The Rock tore like half a dozen muscles in his body. He was so injured and had to have surgery when the match was over. And he was almost 10 years younger in that match than he would be next year for this match. So yes, if you're a movie studio and you're working with Dwayne Johnson, I can understand why you would have reservations about him stepping back in the ring. But if you can get The Rock for a match, they would be crazy not to do it, almost regardless of who it's against. If you can get The Rock to commit to a match on a big show, you would be insane to not book him for that match. And with Roman, the whole tribal chief thing, head of the table, it just would lend itself so well. So it seems like they're hoping. WWE can hope. Doesn't mean they're going to get him. But they're hoping to get The Rock in Brooklyn for Survivor Series. And it sounds like WWE may be having second thoughts about releasing two of the more shocking names that they let go of in recent months. PW Insider says that in some parts of the company, there have been talks in WWE that it was an accident to cut Aleister Black. Water is wet. Grass is green. No shit, Sherlock. It was an accident. Oops, maybe we shouldn't have done that. You know, this guy that we just put back on television. Maybe we shouldn't have gotten rid of him so fast. And there is now said to be a push in some circles to bring him back. I don't know what circles these are. I don't know if there's any influential people in these circles. It could be lower level people in the company who realize that it was a dumb decision. Doesn't mean they're going to bring him back. The only thing that matters is if people in power in that company want to bring him back. Lower level people, they don't mean shit when it comes to making decisions about who to hire and who to fire. So I don't know what circles these are. But I read this and I'm just like, are you kidding me? Fuck them. They sat this guy home for 6 months and had absolutely no plans for him. They finally bring him back only to turn around and fire him. And now they want him back? Fuck them. The rumor is he may already have a deal lined up with AEW anyway. Nothing is signed, nothing is official, but he could be headed there. Outside of money, and I don't get the sense from listening to him the past couple of weeks and some of the interviews he's done, you know, the one with Renee or even on his Twitch stream, I don't get the sense that money is kind of, it's not his primary motivator here. After being treated the way that he was, why the hell would he want to go back? I mean, he might. He might. The Stockholm Syndrome was very strong on that Twitch stream that he did. He might actually have bought into that bullshit that Vince McMahon was high on him. He might have drank the Kool-Aid. He might be willing to go back. Or maybe he just really liked it there. Who knows? But my God, why would he go back? Maybe in a few years, but why would he go back right now? And then there's Samoa Joe, who was released back on April 15th in that wave of cuts coming out of WrestleMania. According to a report from Fightful, multiple people on the NXT side have said that NXT officials are interested in bringing Joe back to the brand as an active wrestler, although I guess other roles have been discussed for him as well. You know, before they cut him, they were using Joe to do sit-down interviews with talent. We even got one with Joe and Walter. So you can use Joe in a variety of ways, but, you know, back in the ring is really where he should be. This is said to be only speculation right now. They are not reporting on this as fact or that he is imminently coming back. It's all speculation within people in the company. People in NXT are talking about this. This reeks of letting him go just so they could sign him to a new deal for less money. I'm sure Joe was making very good money. Was he making seven figures? Probably not. Was he making upper six figures? Probably not, but who knows, right? I don't know. But that's what this smells like. Let's get rid of this guy, and then we can bring him in for less money. If it's strictly an NXT thing, and they actually want him in the ring and not just behind a desk with a headset on, it does intrigue me. It's a little bit different from the Aleister thing. The Aleister thing just was complete madness. Like, the reason Joe wasn't in the ring was injury-related, so it's kind of a different situation. The idea of him coming back to NXT, I find it intriguing. You know, Joe in NXT against Karrion Kross, against Adam Cole. I mean, fuck Joe and Walter. I pitched a whole storyline for that right before they fired Joe. But again, I don't know that I could do business with somebody who just fired me and now wants to bring me back for less money, if that's what this is. I would just like to see him get one more run somewhere. Maybe his body won't allow it. Maybe he is injury prone. But he's a hell of a talker. He's got the gift of gab. We know that. There's few people in wrestling, even today, better than Samoa Joe on the mic. If his body allows it, he could still be a player. Last Sunday, A&E profiled Bret the Hitman Hart in its biography series, which nearly matched NXT in its total audience this week and actually beat NXT in the key demo that everybody loves to talk about. NXT got beat by the Bret Hart biography. Bret is my favorite of all time. The GOAT, as they say. So I knew it was going to be all stuff that I already knew, but I thought this was the best one that they've done yet. Although I will admit, I did not see the Mick Foley episode. That's the only one that I've missed so far, and I heard good things about that one too. But this was a very enjoyable 2 hours covering his early life through the Stampede days into WWE, a handful of his greatest matches, of course the Montreal Screwjob. You can't tell the Bret Hart story without talking about him punching Vince McMahon in the face. It's just a great story. Right on through the death of Owen Hart, his retirement from the ring, the stroke, and his recovery from all of the negative shit that he's been through, to remarrying a woman about 25 years his junior, and finally being in a great place in his life. This was not a story about Bret Hart, the bitter man. You know, Bret Hart buries the world. It was a story with a happy ending. I liked how much they went into his drawings. He's a really good cartoon illustrator. He's not a drawer the level of Jerry Lawler. Lawler has a gift that few people have. But Bret's not too bad himself. And neither is Dexter Loomis, actually. But they talked about Bret's, his drawings and how he used to draw stuff that would pop Andre the Giant and guys in the locker room back in the day. I love the footage of him watching his student film back. The lizard, I thought that was cool. He was studying filmmaking before he finally decided to get into the family business, and he was just a natural at it. You know, there was nobody better than Brett when it came to making a match believable. He gets criticized for taking wrestling and taking himself too seriously, and he did. But I think that was part of why everything that he did came across that way, because of how seriously he treated it. Every match felt like a war. Nothing was done for comedy. Nothing was, you know, you can believe everything that this guy said and everything that this guy did. They covered the sibling rivalry story with Owen, which is still fantastic all these years later. And to think, you know, WWE wanted Bruce Hart for that role, but Brett was the one who insisted on Owen getting the spot. The WCW deal, he was initially offered $2.8 million for 3 years, plus royalties. And he ended up taking the WWE deal, which was $10 million over a period of 20 years. Considerably less money, but he never wanted to leave. And the people who sort of poo-poo that's all the proof you need. If it was purely a financial decision, then you take the $3 million a year and keep your mouth shut. And he didn't. Not until Vince told him, look, I can't afford to pay you anymore. We're going to breach your contract. I give you my blessing to go negotiate with Turner and Eric Bischoff. They did mention the Sunny Days comment on Raw from Shawn Michaels, which is what led to the little cat fight that he and Shawn had backstage at Raw in Hartford. That was when Shawn went home claiming unsafe working conditions. And then later, when Vince tells him that he's dropping the title to Shawn Michaels, he goes to Shawn and tells him, look, I just want you to know that I've got no problem dropping the belt to you. And Shawn replies back, well, that's great, but I just want you to know that I'm not willing to do the same thing for you. And that really, you know, lost in all this Montreal talk about him not wanting to lose in Canada, blah, blah, blah. That, I think, more than anything, that gets underplayed. That one exchange backstage one day at an event when Brett was trying to be the bigger man, not that Brett was totally innocent in everything that happened with him and Shawn, but in that instance, he went to Shawn and said, look, I'm willing to put the past behind us and I'm willing to do business the right way. And Shawn said, well, that's great, but I'm not. That, I think, more than anything, is what led to the whole fiasco at Survivor Series. That's when Vince McMahon should have taken control as a leader and gotten both of these guys in a room together to hash things out, but he didn't do it. He thrived on that. A lot of top guys have talked about that over the years. Vince McMahon thrived on competition between his top talent. Now, having said that, I said Brett's not totally innocent here. They played the secret audio from the meeting backstage at Survivor Series before the match with Brett and Vince, which was for the Wrestling with Shadows documentary. Vince didn't realize that Brett was still mic'd up, or maybe he did and he didn't care, but I doubt that. And he tells Brett, you know, for the finish, whatever you want to do, we'll do whatever you want to do. And Brett says, well, we could do a DQ finish and then I can come out and do a speech on TV the next night and forfeit the title. I think with my head held high, you know, that would be the way to go. And I'm sure that in his head, that sounded nice, but that was a ridiculous request. You don't just give a speech and hand over the belt. You drop the belt. And I know he has said that he offered to lose it to anybody else, even the Brooklyn Brawler, just not Shawn Michaels, not in Montreal. But here, he wants to do a speech and say goodbye and just hand the belt over. You can't do that. Just the nature of how things were at that time. He's going to WCW. You have to drop it in the ring and put somebody over for it. So when I listened to that again and heard him talk about the speech and the ring and I'll just hand it over, I just rolled my eyes. I laughed out loud when he talked about Goldberg and the kick to the head that ended his career. And he says that on a scale of 1 to 10 as a wrestler, he would rank Goldberg as a 0. He never holds back when he talks about Goldberg. It's so weird because he's done interviews over the years where he talks almost in a complimentary way about Goldberg. Well, it was a mistake. Accidents happen. And, you know, he and Goldberg, I feel like they've buried the hatchet before. But then he'll do interviews even now where it's like, oh, the guy was a zero. He couldn't wrestle. He was so reckless. Look at what he did to me. Just, I don't know. It's weird. Because it just doesn't seem to be terribly consistent. Because I feel like he has kind of talked about forgiving, you know, Bill in the past. But maybe he's had a change of heart. Bret Hart has had a change of heart. But at the end, yeah, the stuff with his wife, his family, I thought was very nice. I'm glad he has finally found peace. And I don't mean Montreal, but he's had a lot of tragedy in his family and in his sort of inner circle. I mean, Pillman, Owen, Davey Boy, his brother Dean, many, many years ago, died early of this very rare disease. And the man has lost a ton of friends in the wrestling business. I know he was very close with Rick Rude and Brian Adams, Crush. Of course, Jim Neidhart, Randy Savage. I mean, so this guy has had a lot of loss in his life. The stroke that he had, he battled prostate cancer. It's just nice to see him doing well and that he's still here, and long may he be here. Bret is the one guy, if you force me to pick just one, whose matches I could go back and just watch, just kind of like drop everything and go watch his work, it's Bret Hart. And this week is the anniversary of one of his greatest performances, my all-time favorite WWE pay-per-view, which I'm going to be getting to here in just a little bit. But before we get to that, we have to talk about Monday Night Raw.
You can't write it any better than this. Even if you work on Monday Night Raw.
I do love those Paul Heyman digs in Monday Night Raw. The Viking Raiders won a tag team battle royal to become number one contenders to the tag team titles. Of the teams that were involved, they were the best choice to win this. Orton and Riddle, you have to save for SummerSlam, although I will say, I like that they kept Mace and T-Bar together as a team because they need teams. And I think Mace has a good look. You know, now the mask is off and everything, but the size and everything, he's got a good look. There's something there with him. I said that even through all the horribleness of Retribution. Dijak, if they ever separate these two and they go solo, I fear for him. He does not have a good future on the main roster if he goes solo. I don't see it. But Mace could. Jackson Ryker is indeed a babyface now. He had a match with Elias, which saw Elias run away for the countout. I cannot bring myself to care about anything either of these men do. So putting them together on television actually might not be such a bad thing. Because if you put the two of them together, then I know that's a segment that I could always just completely avoid. If you could bottle this up and sell it, it would be to television viewers what insect repellent is to mosquitoes. We had a contract signing with Drew McIntyre and Bobby Lashley for their match at Hell in a Cell. Standard fare here as contract signings go, aside from McIntyre cutting the table in half with a sword at the very end. I can't say that I ever remember seeing that before. But I like the stipulations they added. If Lashley wins, Drew can never again challenge him for the WWE title. Drew accepted, but he wanted something in return. He wanted the match inside the cell. A stunning revelation, I know, for a pay-per-view called Hell in a Cell. But Lashley's stipulation should put an end, finally, to this feud. Unless McIntyre wins the belt back, and then it feels like there's a strong chance that that might happen. Then I guess Lashley could get a rematch, so I'm not going to assume anything about this being the end. We all know what happens when one makes assumptions about WWE booking. But if Lashley does lose the title, that wouldn't stop them from doing Lashley against Lesnar at SummerSlam. But if they're going to do it, I think it should be for the championship. Otherwise, you got the WWE title probably, what, third from the top on that pay-per-view instead of second? But either way, the Universal title is going to be in the top spot when they get to Las Vegas. Poor Sheamus had his face mangled by that gobshite Humberto Carrillo 2 weeks ago. Gobshite. Is that what he called him? Right? That's what I wrote down here. That sounds like something translated that would have been bleeped off the show, but he may have gotten away with saying it. I'll let one of my Irish listeners clarify what he actually said, but He's wearing a face mask until he gets cleared to return to the ring. So Ricochet and Humberto had a match against each other that ended in a double countout after Ricochet hit a Spanish fly off the apron to the floor, and neither man could make it back in the ring in time. This feels like they're just killing time until Sheamus is cleared, and then we'll end up getting a triple threat for the U.S. title, which actually, that match should be pretty good. Just don't know when we're actually going to get to see it. I really liked the backstage segment with MVP confronting Kofi Kingston. There was no comedy, no funny jokes, no Xavier Woods playing his trombone. Kofi was getting ready for a match with Matt Riddle later in the show, which he won. When MVP walked up to him and talked about shedding tears of joy 2 years ago after Kofi won the WWE title at WrestleMania, which is true. There's even video of it. It was MVP and Shad Gaspard both crying. And now it makes me sad when I think of that video, knowing that Shad was gone a little over a year later. MVP said that after Kingston's loss to Drew McIntyre, it looked like he was content with just being a loser and just shooking and jiving with his friends, and Kofi told him to watch his mouth. He does this for all the kids who may be out there watching. Less and less of them every week, but yes, there are kids, in fact, that watch this show. I just love the interaction between the two of them. I don't know if it's going anywhere. I just can't see WWE having the guts to break up the New Day and turn Kofi Kingston heel, but I'll tell you what, that would be a shot in the arm for Kofi Kingston if they did. I just don't think they have the guts to do it. Nikki Cross and Asuka beat Charlotte and Rhea Ripley, the old opponents as tag team partners booking. Ah, yes. There's something we haven't seen before. And the Raw Women's Champion loses again. They're feeding wins to Nikki Cross, though. So they may as well add her to the match at this point at Hell in a Cell. She keeps winning. She's involved with these two women. Why is this not a triple threat? The booking heading into this women's championship match at Hell in a Cell has been atrocious. No more atrocious than what I am about to talk about. The main event of this show, and probably the only thing that people have been wanting to hear me talk about, was an Alexa's Playground segment. That was the main event of this show. And I will go through this because I know a lot of you don't even watch this show anymore. Alexa is in the ring, on her swing, talking to her doll, Lily. Shayna Baszler comes out and knocks over Alexa's toy horse, her little horsey. Bliss wanted Shayna to apologize to Lily. And Shayna blamed Alexa for her and Nia Jax no longer being the women's tag team champions. She should be thanking Alexa for that, not yelling at her. Shayna grabbed Lily. She grabbed the doll and she began to talk to it. I'm sorry. She's apologizing to the doll. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you're just a stupid doll. And this angered Bliss, who attacked Baszler. Baszler then sent Alexa out to the floor. And as if this wasn't all ridiculous enough, we make movies in this company. Remember that? They have these dramatic camera cuts. One from the doll's point of view, looking up at Shayna, who had her foot on the doll, and she proceeds to stomp on the doll. And that is when all the voodoo magic began. The lights began to flicker. Shayna fled to the she fled from the ring. Up the aisleway, flames began to shoot up from both sides of the ramp, and Shayna ran to the back, and the cameras followed her. They were playing spooky music. This was their version of a horror movie. I don't know why this was needed. They already produce a 3-hour horror movie every Monday night. Shayna was acting terrified, trying to find refuge in one of the rooms backstage. There was nobody else around, by the way. Everybody had left for the night, I guess. It's like these movies sometimes where somebody is being chased in a hospital and there's nobody else around. It's like, what kind of hospital is this? There's nobody around? You've got to suspend your disbelief quite a bit. But she's, you know, just looking for some safe haven here in the back. She barricades herself into a room only to turn around and find the doll is reflected in the mirror. And she turns around, no doll. Turns back around, and there's the doll again in the mirror. So she kicks the mirror and she shatters it, condemning herself to 7 more years of bad booking. But the doll can still be seen reflected in the shattered glass. And they fade to black, and the last thing we hear was Shayna Baszler screaming. She probably wakes up in a cold sweat every Monday morning, screaming like that, when she remembers that they have Raw that night. Oh God, what have they written for me now? You know, if you would have told me that Shayna Baszler would be featured in multiple weeks of Raw main events, I would have said, hey, that's great. That's great news if you're a fan of Shayna Baszler. But if I told you what she would be doing in those main events, you would have told me I'm not supposed to fill my bong up with bleach before using it. That's not how it works. Now, I'm a horror fan. I've watched plenty of movies with killer dolls. At no point did I find myself wanting Chucky or Annabelle to start doing dives and rolling up their victims. I have a certain level of tolerance for stupid shit on my wrestling shows. When Papa Shango started setting jobbers' feet on fire as a 10-year-old, that kind of freaked me out. Ultimate Warrior vomiting up split pea soup, that was dumb even back then. When Kane summoned a lightning bolt and set one of the crew members on fire, that was a cool moment. And it was a one-time deal, we never saw him do it again. Kane was also an ass-kicking machine who could back it up in the ring. Nobody's going to make fun of Kane, not back then. Same with Undertaker. When The Fiend first debuted, I loved those Funhouse Bray skits. You could argue that he was just a guy that went off the deep end, he lost his mind, and that somehow made him more dangerous and more sinister. When The Fiend made that first entrance, that was the coolest thing on that SummerSlam show. But everything has a shelf life. Nothing lasts forever. The Fiend was bungled and has not been the same since. And now, Alexa Bliss has taken over, basically, as the new Fiend. The Fiend now sits down to pee instead of standing up. And kudos to Alexa Bliss on her character work. She has done as good a job with it as you can ask for. But everything has a shelf life. Demonic Bliss in small doses would have been fine until she finally, eventually snaps out of her trance. Instead, they have leaned into it even more, and every week it just gets worse and worse and worse. We are now going on a year. One full year of this. And Bray Wyatt, nowhere to be found. You know what? I'm okay with that. He shouldn't be on television every week anyway. Small doses. It's like a drug, right? You don't want to take heavy doses. Small doses. That character is best saved for when they actually have something for him to do. Mike Johnson of PW Insider says that they've been keeping him hidden away on purpose. I can only imagine for some kind of grand reappearance where maybe he breaks the spell and we get the old Alexa Bliss back. July 16th cannot get here soon enough. July 16th is when WWE gets back on the road. It gets back on the road in front of live crowds, and I refuse to believe that those live crowds are going to be any nicer to this than I am. Unless I have just completely lost the plot on this, and hey, maybe I have. Maybe this is the kind of stuff that people are into these days, and it has passed me by. All 1.6 million of these people every Monday are into this kind of stuff. The numbers certainly don't bear this out. And if these are the kinds of Raw main events they plan on giving people next month, these people are in for a rude awakening. If fans want to pay for a ticket to see a scary movie, they'll go to the multiplex. Monday Night Raw has never been more embarrassing than it is today. And I watched an old lady give birth to a fucking hand. But at least she didn't come back the next week and pop out another one and another, week after week after week. But if she did, you know what she would be doing? She would be Googling WebMD to find out why that keeps happening. And she wouldn't want anybody spying on her internet activity, which is why she would be using ExpressVPN. How did you choose which internet service provider to use? Because the sad thing is, most of us have very little choice between ISPs. Because they operate like monopolies in the regions they serve. And then, they use this monopoly power to take advantage of customers with data caps, streaming throttles. The list goes on. But worst of all, many ISPs log your internet activity and they sell that data to other big tech companies or advertisers. To prevent ISPs from seeing my internet activity, I protect all of my devices with ExpressVPN. So what is ExpressVPN? It's a simple app for your computer or your smartphone that encrypts all of your network data and tunnels it through a secure VPN server so that your ISP cannot see any of your activity. Just think about how much of your life is on the internet. The list of people that you've messaged, the sites you've visited, the videos you've watched, they all get tracked by tech giants who can then turn around and sell your information for profit. That's the reason I recommend ExpressVPN is the best way to hide your online activity from your ISP. You just download the app, you tap one button on your device, and you're protected. And ExpressVPN does all of this without slowing your connection. That's why it's rated the number one VPN service by CNET and Wired. So stop handing over your personal data to ISPs and other tech giants who mine your activity and sell off your information. Protect yourself with the VPN that I trust to keep me private online. Visit expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. expressvpn.com/solomonster to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/solomonster right now to learn more. SmackDown. I enjoyed SmackDown this week. I thought it was an easy watch. Poor Jey Uso being pulled in two different directions. Roman Reigns is still playing mind games with this guy. But not just Jey. He's playing mind games now with his brother, Jimmy. Jimmy Uso wanted Roman to come to his dressing room, which he did. And as he and Jimmy were arguing back and forth, Jey had enough. And he said, I'm sick of this. I'm sick of Jimmy. I'm sick of Roman. And he walked out. And Roman tried to play it up like, now look what you've done. Why would you do that to your brother? How could you just let him walk out like that? You were gone for a year. During that time, Jey elevated himself and you're trying to bring him down. You need to go make it right with him. And Jimmy walked off to go find his brother. Even he is falling for the games. The master manipulator. That is Roman Reigns. See, this is good storytelling. I know it's getting repetitive every week, but this is storytelling done right. And all three of these guys are knocking it out of the park every week. Big E was back, tagging with Kevin Owens against Apollo Crews and Sami Zayn. Alistair who? Owens pinned Zayn after a stunner. Crews was not happy. He challenged them to a rematch this Friday, but this time, with Commander Aziz as his partner, he laid out Zayn after did Aziz with the Nigerian nail. They're really putting that move over strong. Bayley had Seth Rollins on her Ding Dong Hello show. She even spruced up the place with a bunch of pictures of herself on easels. They were hamming it up together and laughing at footage of Rollins attacking Cesaro a few weeks ago. Suddenly, the doorbell rang. Rollins opens the door, and guess who was at the door? Cesaro, who beat the crap out of him and destroyed the set. Bayley was not happy. And then Bianca Belair walks out, does the obnoxious fake laugh to Bayley like Bayley did to her the week before. The heels were absurdly obnoxious here, and they got their comeuppance for it. The best part of this, though, was the production botch. When Bayley came out, they flashed a graphic on the screen that called Bayley WWE Champion Brock Lesnar with Paul Heyman. It was so quick, they immediately took it off, but everybody saw it. You know, the last time Lesnar was on SmackDown, he was probably the WWE champion with Paul Heyman. So I guess they still had the graphic filed away. Now I want Bayley to do the Lesnar entrance when she comes out next week and bounce up and down the way that Brock does. Otis has shaved his beard. A moment of silence. Mandy Rose will not be pleased. Chad Gable left him in the back, though, while he wrestled Montez Ford. Ford hit the giant frog splash, which is his finish, But Otis missed his cue, and or didn't miss his cue so much as he just couldn't get to the ring in time to break up the fall, which I'm sure is what the finish was supposed to be. So Gable had to kick out of the frog splash at the last possible second. Then Otis hit the ring for the DQ. He destroyed Montez with splashes. Otis has a mean streak now. No more funny business. I like this new attitude. We had another fucking match between Shinsuke Nakamura and Baron Corbin. What is that? Third straight week now? Maybe fourth? They didn't even give either man an entrance. They got the jobber entrance. Nakamura picked up the win to even things up between them. Corbin and Rick Boogs each made a mad dash after the match for the crown that was sitting on the announce desk. Corbin grabbed it, but then Nakamura stole it right back out of his hand. Adam Pearce in the back made a match for SmackDown this Friday, so add another match to the pile between these two. This time it will be for possession of the crown. The Battle of the Crown, they're calling it, which is completely ridiculous. Corbin is the King of the Ring. Now, he's been King of the Ring for years, it feels like. But he is the king. It is his crown. The man stole it. This has to be leading to a no contest, and the crown is put up in another King of the Ring tournament. It has to. Rey Mysterio, earlier in the back, cut one of the better promos of his career on Roman Reigns for what he did to not only him, but his son Dominic last week. Beat the crap out of him. Rey was great. I thought Rey was fantastic in that segment. He came out to the ring at the end of the show, looking for Roman Reigns to confront him. Roman obliged. Rey challenged him to a match inside Hell in a Cell, which Roman did not even have a chance to accept before Rey attacked him with a kendo stick. Roman got the upper hand with a Superman punch. He was setting up for the spear. He did the whole ooh-ah thing, right? Ooh-ah. Wasn't there a song many years ago? I'm trying to think. It was like a club song. Oh my God, who sang that song? Was it Gina something? It was like, ooh, ah, just a little bit. Ooh, ah. I feel like there's a, it's been a while since I've worked on one of these little opening skits. I may have to put that together. Take the Roman Reigns ooh, ah, and plug it into that song. I might have to do that. I don't know why I thought of that. Anyway, Roman was getting ready to do the spear when Dominic showed up, and he attacked. And Roman, though, got the upper hand. He got Dominic in position for a powerbomb, and he powerbombed Dominic from the ring out to the floor. The way they shot this was perfect. AEW could learn from the camera angle that they used here the next time they do a big spot like the one they did at Blood and Guts. Obviously, they used the crash pad for Dominic's landing, but they never showed it. All we saw was Roman launching this kid out of the ring like a rocket. It looked great. 20 seconds later, we saw Dominic writhing around on the floor in agony. Rey went to go check on him. He got booted in the head for his trouble, and Roman stood tall to end the show. The match is official. Paul Heyman accepted on Roman's behalf on Talking Smack. It will be for the Universal title. I was kind of hoping it wouldn't be. I think that's a mistake. It would be better if it wasn't for the championship. No one expects Rey Mysterio to win the title at Hell in a Cell. That way, if it was non-title, I think people could buy into the possibility that Rey might win. Maybe you know, Jimmy Uso gets involved or something. It might be a cheap victory, but a win is a win. But if the title is on the line, there is zero doubt as to the outcome of that match. But I still think the match is going to be excellent. Dominic gets to watch his father die inside the cell on Father's Day. What a wonderful gift. Let's talk about All Elite Wrestling and Impact Wrestling. There was an Impact AEW Summit on Thursday's Impact show, which Tony Khan was present for, as was Scott D'Amore and Don Callis. On that show, it was announced that Kenny Omega would defend the Impact World title against Moose one-on-one, even though Sami Callihan got a win over Moose by DQ the week before. And Omega would have home field advantage because the match would take place at Daly's Place in Jacksonville, I guess to prevent the Good Brothers from getting involved, because the Good Brothers had a match of their own in Nashville on the Against All Odds pay-per-view that took place last night. So instead, the main event, which I don't know when it was taped, but maybe it was live. Obviously, it wasn't. Clearly, it wasn't. I'll get to why in a second. But the main event took place in Jacksonville at Daly's Place. Scott D'Amore did mention, though, that Sami Callihan would get his title shot at the Impact Slammiversary pay-per-view in Nashville next month. It's on July 17th. And so last night we had Kenny Omega one-on-one at Against All Odds against Moose. The Young Bucks appeared at the end of the match. Yes, Max and Jeremy Buck made their Impact returns last night. There was a ref bump. The Bucks appeared, they super kicked Moose, they laid him out with the BTE trigger, and then they helped Kenny Omega lift up Moose. Moose is a big guy, and they lifted him up so Omega could hit the one-winged angel to retain the championship. And so Kenny Omega, to the surprise of no one, retains his title. You know, Omega is said to really be hurting right now. He's dealing with multiple nagging injuries. You could see the cupping marks all over his back and his shoulder. So I have a feeling he may be shedding some of those belts sooner than later if he's really that hurt and he needs time off. I'm surprised that he hasn't had to take time off yet. If you remember the end of last year when he won the world title, there was talk that he was working through a partially torn labrum in his shoulder. Now, I don't know if the labrum is still one of those injuries that's there or if that's healed up on its own. He was going to forego surgery. But clearly, he is hurting, and he is going to have to take some time off soon. But he retains the Impact World title, holds on to that for at least a little bit longer. But, yeah, I mentioned before, not knowing if this match was, you know, when it was taped or if it was live or not. Sami Callihan was in the opener of the pay-per-view last night. It was him and Tommy Dreamer getting a win over the Good Brothers. I guess it gave Callihan enough time to travel, him being in the opener, travel from Nashville all the way to Jacksonville via Rocket. Because after the match was over between Omega and Moose, the lights went out, and there's Sami Callihan in Jacksonville. And he attacked the Young Bucks with a baseball bat. He grabbed a chair. Don Callis was doing commentary with Tony Schiavone and Scott D'Amore. He was very angry about seeing Callihan, and he fired him. Because in storyline, Don Callis is still an executive in Impact, even though in real life he is no longer. He fired Sami Callihan. And this angered Scott D'Amore, and he was arguing with Callis through the tunnel all the way to the back. And that's how the pay-per-view went off the air last night, with Sami Callihan shouting, "Bullshit!" He is now, quote-unquote, fired from Impact Wrestling. Now, that could go a whole bunch of different ways. He's obviously going to get an Impact World title match next month, so I'm sure he'll quickly be rehired, probably by Scott D'Amore. Maybe in storyline, they will fire Don Callis. And then they'll rehire Sami Callihan. Maybe Tony Khan, in storyline, will hire Sami Callihan and bring him in for a few appearances on TNT. There's a bunch of different ways they could go with this, but they are now building to Kenny Omega one-on-one with Sami Callihan at Slammiversary next month. After signing a deal with New Japan and making his AEW debut in the Casino Battle Royal at Double or Nothing, Lio Rush was in the news this week when he suddenly announced his retirement from the ring at the age of 26. He wrote a long post that I will not repeat because it is very long, but he wrote a long post on Instagram revealing that he was injured in that match. He separated the AC joint in his shoulder, and he talked about the effect that it's been having on his everyday life with his family at home, and he had this sort of eureka moment, this revelation where he didn't want to go through this anymore. He did some soul searching, and he decided that it's best to step away and pursue other interests. You know, he's done music. I'm assuming he'll go more into his music. He said once he's all healed up, though, he will be back in the ring to fulfill his contractual obligations for New Japan. So, you know, I guess my question there would be, how long is that contract for? If he signed, let's say, a 2-year deal, I guess he'll have to unretire and then retire again when his deal is up. How many contractual obligations with them does he have exactly? He didn't say. But he just signed that contract in the last, I think, couple of months. But he'll be back. He'll be back. He's 26 years old. He's already teased retirement once before after he left WWE. Guaranteed this guy's going to be back. This is not the last of Lio Rush in a wrestling ring, even after he fulfills his contractual obligations with New Japan. I guarantee it. He'll take a break. Maybe he'll even go away for a while. But I guarantee you, we will see Lio Rush back in the ring. He will be unretiring before long. And in case you were wondering, with Rush and Mark Henry debuting on the same night at Double or Nothing and being in the same building together, if they spoke to one another, because last year, remember, Mark Henry threatened to sue Lio Rush for defamation over comments that Lio Rush made about him when he was talking about his time in WWE. And they did indeed speak. They had what Rush said was a very in-depth conversation to hash things out, and he was looking forward to the future. This was before he announced his retirement. Speaking of the world's strongest man, Mark Henry was on Rene Paquette's Oral Sessions podcast. And brace yourselves, diehards. He had some criticism to offer, constructive criticism about the AEW product. Now, before the steam comes out of your ears, just listen to what he had to say here. Hat tip to Fightful for the transcript. We have to work on the social media aspect of what's going out and what's being portrayed, that you want to be an example of what people see. AEW is more brash and has more of an adult feel, but you have to counterbalance that. You have to do stuff in the community and with live events where you can give back to the city and be an example instead of a problem. Wrestling-wise, I want everyone to watch the matches before them because there is a repetition thing. Someone will do a tope, and the next match will have two topes, and the next will have three. Stop trying to outdo what you saw before and find something else to do. Repetition is a pet peeve of mine, and I feel you're not watching the product if you go do something and someone else did the same thing. I love the Bucks doing super kicks. Why are there three matches on the card where someone does a super kick before them? If that was me, I would be upset about that. He is absolutely right in everything that he said. The dives and the super kicks in wrestling, not just AEW, they're out of control. But he makes a great point. If you have somebody who, like the Bucks, right? The whole super kick party thing, that's their thing. I feel like in wrestling now, though, the problem is that people, super kicks, it's like breathing. It's like breathing oxygen. If you take a breath, if you blink your eyes, that's how commonplace super kicks have now become. But he's right. If you're on the card and there are moves like that that you're known for that you do, and in the match before you and the match before that, people are doing the same shit, you know, that would irk me. They lose all impact when people do them. When everybody does them, it just loses whatever impact it has. But I have nothing else beyond that to add to what Mark Henry just said. He is 100% correct. Dynamite on Friday, or for me, Saturday, because I ain't watching four straight hours of wrestling unless it's a pay-per-view. If I graded it, I think 6 out of 10 would be fair. I wouldn't go higher than that. We had a rare Jack Evans and Angelico sighting on Dynamite with Christian Cage pinning Angelico. Matt Hardy attacked Christian after the match and Jungle Boy came to his aid. Can't say that I'm a fan of Hardy and Christian, you know, being paired off as old foes. We've seen this before, but I do want to see more of Christian in the ring with people like Angelico and people that I've never seen him work with before. Cody Rhodes, all week, was hyping up another one of his special announcements, which was that next week he will be tagging with Brock. No, not that Brock. Brock Anderson, the son of Arn Anderson. No paternity test needed. You just take one look at this kid and you can tell who the father is. Brock was out there looking like he was dressed for a family barbecue. They're going to be wrestling QT Marshall and Aaron Solo on next week's show. QT said that when they go back out on the road, he wants a full house to see him literally whip Cody's ass. He challenged him to a South Beach strap match on the July 7th Dynamite in Miami. Cody wanted to do the match right now. QT pulled off his belt and instead he whipped Arn Anderson with it. Right in the back, So Brock tackled him and officials broke it up. Eddie Kingston down a partner with John Moxley out on baby watch. I think Renee should be popping any day now. Eddie Kingston tagged with his best friend, or I guess former best friend, Penta, and Pac. I guess the Pentagon pairing with Alex Abrahantes is done, which is too bad because I thought it worked. They beat Brandon Cutler and the Young Bucks. Of course, Cutler took the fall. It's the only reason he was in that match to begin with. We heard from the Pinnacle for the first time since Stadium Stampede. Harwood and Wheeler called out Santana and Ortiz. Sean Spears called Sammy Guevara a glorified indie wrestler and isn't finished with him. Wardlow said Jake Hager is obsessed with him. He accepted Hager's challenge to an MMA cage fight next week. MJF was the contrarian one. He denied Chris Jericho's request for a match. He also called Sammy a chicken shit, so they're teasing a match with him and Sammy Guevara. Jericho popped up on screen. He was in the parking lot with the rest of the Inner Circle, who vandalized and destroyed the same limousine that the Pinnacle arrived in at the venue at the start of the show. They used the baseball bats, sledgehammers, until Hager showed up driving a forklift. He rammed it into the side of the limo, lifted it up off the ground, lowered it back down. The Inner Circle rode off. They rode away on the forklift, flipping off the Pinnacle. They got to get some heat back on the Pinnacle soon, is all I got to say. Elsewhere, Darby Allin responded to Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page's challenge for him to pick a partner other than Sting. Darby told Sting, stay home next week. He's going to go into this match alone in a handicap match, 1-on-2. Sting said, well, if that's what you want, I'll stay home. I wish Tony Khan had told Sting to stay home a few times after he debuted instead of putting him on TV every week. Here's what I want this Friday. I want a split screen of Sting, while this match is going on, of Sting at home in his Lazy Boy with his makeup on, feet up, beer in his hand, watching TNT. Maybe a little bag of Cheetos. Or at least a Photoshop. Someone's got to get on that for me. Miro successfully defended the TNT title against Evil Uno. They aired a nice little video package before the match and an Evil Uno promo talking about Brody Lee being TNT champion and how much it would mean for him to hold that same title. But he failed. He failed Brody and he lost to Miro. Brody's son, -1, was back out there with the other Dark Order members on stage rooting on Evil Uno. If you'll notice, -1 was gone for a while because his grades in school slipped a little bit. His mom, Amanda, posted on Instagram that she had told him he can have fun with his wrestling friends if he kept his grades up in school. Otherwise, he wouldn't be allowed to make any more appearances, which apparently is what happened. And I guess he got his grades back up, and so he was back on TV. See, that's parenting done right. You can't go play with your wrestling friends. You can't play with the Dark Order on television unless you keep your grades up. That's what a mother does. Always take interest in your child's studies. Don't be a deadbeat. Pay attention. Little PSA there from the Solomonster. There was no Andrade appearance this week, but they did air a video for him showing him putting on his suit. They never showed his face, but apparently he dresses very nicely. This Friday, Jim Ross will be doing a sit-down interview with Andre. That's got to be a rib. It's got to be a rib. If he starts the interview welcoming him as Andre again, I may have to go live. I'm not planning on going live Friday night because this Dynamite is airing on Friday again this week. But if he does that, I might just have to go live. We got a segment with Kenny Omega and Don Callis rambling on about Omega's title defense against Jungle Boy on the 26th. Jungle Boy walked out, didn't say much. He just looked at Omega and he said, "You talk way too much." Guarantee you they only did that to make the next Botchamania video. Omega went to attack him, but Jungle Boy was ready for it, tried to put him in the snare trap. But the Young Bucks ran out, and Jungle Boy bailed. Nyla Rose picked up a win over Layla Hirsch. This was not very good. Britt Baker was still talking about Nyla in her promo with Tony Schiavone, so they are indeed building to a match between two heels, basically. And in the main event, Hangman Page and 10 of the Dark Order beat Brian Cage and Powerhouse Hobbs. Much like Double or Nothing, Ricky Starks tossed the FTW title to Cage for him to use as a weapon at the finish, but Cage threw it back. This time, Starks got up in his face. He slapped him, which angered Cage, who slowly, I say chased, but kind of walked him to the back. He couldn't hit him because Starks isn't cleared. That left Hobbs all by himself with Hangman hitting the Buckshot Lariat, and he let 10 pick up the win. He let 10 pick up the 3. So the trouble in Team Taz is about to blow over. It sucks that Starks got hurt when he did, because I was looking forward to a match with him and Christian. I still would like to see Christian Cage one-on-one with Ricky Starks when Starks is back. When AEW hits the road next month, their first few shows will all have a special theme, which is smart if you're trying to lure people back in. July 7th in Miami is their Road Rager, July 14th in Cedar Park, Texas, and July 21st in Garland, Texas will be nights 1 and 2 of Fyter Fest, and July 28th in Charlotte, North Carolina will be their annual Fight for the Fallen show. I loved hearing from some of you after I talked about my last meal kit from HelloFresh. That was the Honey Thyme Pork Tenderloin with roasted potatoes and Brussels sprouts, which I love. I love Brussels sprouts. I don't know how I never started eating them until I was in my 30s, but I'm glad I started. And I just cooked my second HelloFresh meal last night, and it turned out just as good as the first. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and recipes delivered right to your door. It's easy, it's fun, it's affordable, and that is why it is America's number one meal kit. The recipes are easy to follow, quick to make, and they cut out the need for meal planning and grocery store trips, so you can get dinner on the table, usually in 30 minutes or less. And not just dinner, they've got quick and easy breakfast and lunch meals too that you can make on the go to fit in with your busy lifestyle. HelloFresh also offers the flexibility that you need with customizable orders each week. You can add extra proteins and sides, change up the serving size when you're expecting guests, or you can just double up on your favorite recipes. If you need to change your delivery day or skip a week, no problem. My masterpiece, my most recent masterpiece the other night, and I put the pictures up on Twitter, was cherry balsamic pork chops with broccoli and thyme roasted potatoes. Fantastic. Magnifico. And it's great too because it's filling. You know, one of my concerns when I first tried this the first time was, okay, the food looks great, which in pictures it does, but am I still going to be hungry when I'm done? Am I going to want to go for a snack as soon as I'm done having dinner? The answer is no. I found the serving size per person to be just right. The way they have everything measured out, the directions laid out for you, it is very convenient, and I cannot recommend this kit enough. So now it's your turn. Go to HelloFresh.com/SolaMonster12 and use code SolaMonster12, that's the number 12, for 12 free meals, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/SolaMonster12 and use the code SolaMonster12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping, for HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit.
History has been made here!
This week, in Wrestling History, features two of my all-time favorite WWE pay-per-views. The first, taking place 28 years ago this week, on June 13th, 1993, from the Nutter Center in Dayton, Ohio. The very first King of the Ring pay-per-view, not the first King of the Ring. The tournament dates back to 1985. It used to be a house show attraction that they had started doing. But they went from the big four pay-per-views to the big five. WWE was working with the USWA at that time and sending some of its talent to work there, including Papa Shango, who was not doing anything on television by this point. But he beat Jerry Lawler to win the USWA title the month before, Lawler also happens to be the first man that Shango ever wrestled back in his Soul Taker days. And I believe he won the USWA title from him there as well. I think he beat him for it back in 89. Might have been his very first match. But he beat him for it again here in 93. And on this show, the reason I mention this is because he defended it against Owen Hart in a dark match before the King of the Ring pay-per-view went on the air. Owen then beat him for the belt about a week after this. But this was the Bret Hart show. This was not the Owen Hart show. This was the Bret Hart show. This was a total one-man show. And the rest of the show, to be perfectly honest with you, really wasn't anything overly special. But I have always loved the, not just the Bret stuff, but the look and the feel of this show. I can't quite put my finger on it, but just there was something about this show, the vibe, I always liked. But it is Bret's performance that makes this so memorable. He worked three matches that night, all on a bad ankle that he had injured the night before, working a half-hour match against Bob Backlund at Madison Square Garden. It was Backlund's first ever pinfall loss at MSG. Then he traveled the 600 miles to Dayton to work another 45 minutes plus in these three matches. Bret did not win any of these matches with the sharpshooter. That was a directive that came from Pat Patterson for reasons that were unknown, even to Bret. He wasn't quite sure why. He was told not to use the sharpshooter, but he didn't. So every finish was different, which is something else that I liked about this. He beat Razor Ramon in the first round, Mr. Perfect in the second, and Bam Bam Bigelow in the third and final round with a victory roll to win the crown. I like this match with Perfect better than their match at SummerSlam 91, and I like that match, but I absolutely love this match. And it was a little bit of a different dynamic as well, both babyfaces coming in. Perfect didn't have the bad back the way that he did in 91, where he was kind of handicapped going into that match, and it was still a great match. So a little bit of a different kind of dynamic here. But if I was going to show somebody who does not watch wrestling and wants to know, hey, what's pro wrestling, right? Not you know, WWE today with, you know, dolls and shit, but like, what is pro wrestling? Give me one match that I could watch that really kind of envelops what pro wrestling is or what pro wrestling should be. This is the match that I show them. This is the match that I would show them. Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect, semifinals, King of the Ring 1993. Bret was of the impression that this tournament would be the launching pad to a title match against Hulk Hogan at SummerSlam. Even in his book, he talks about there being a photo shoot with him and Hulk the month before, where they're playing tug-of-war with the WWF belt. About a week after that, Vince McMahon calls Bret and says, hey, we're going to put the belt back on you, but I've got to sell it to Hogan first. And evidently, Hogan didn't go for it. And when Vince called Bret later on to give him the bad news, Bret was understandably upset. Now, I know Hogan tells a different version of events. He says he was only doing what Vince wanted. I do what I'm told. Hogan dropped the belt back to Yokozuna on this show after Harvey Whippleman, dressed as a photographer at ringside, jumped up on the apron to snap a photo of Hogan when his camera suddenly exploded in Hogan's face. Yokozuna finished him off with Hogan's own leg drop. After Hulk got to the back, Bret was there waiting for him. He was waiting to confront him. And this is what Bret Hart said to Hulk Hogan, according to Bret's book, in Bret's own words. You told me at WrestleMania 9 that you would be happy to return the favor. And as I understand it, now you don't want to even work with me. You won't even put me over and saying I'm not in your league. Well, you're right. You're not in my league. On behalf of myself, my family, and most of the boys in the dressing room, you can go fuck yourself. Hogan responds, brother, you don't know the whole story, brother. And Bret tells him, hey, I got the story right from Vince. If it's not true, then go ahead and set me straight. And Hogan said he couldn't, and when Bret asked him why not, Hogan said, because you just told me to go fuck myself. And Bret said, that's right, and I'll tell you again, go fuck yourself. And with that, Bret headed to the ring for his match with Bam Bam Bigelow. At least we got a great rivalry out of this tournament with Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler. Lawler attacked Bret after it was over during the coronation ceremony. But as Bret said to Vince McMahon when Vince lectured him about being unprofessional with Hogan, you shouldn't have done that. Bret told him, he said, look, winning King of the Ring doesn't pay the same as being the champion. 27 years ago this week on June 9th, 1994, WWE held its first ever Hall of Fame induction ceremony in Baltimore. Andre the Giant was the first inductee the year before, but this was the first actual ceremony. Fred Blassie was inducted by Shane McMahon. Gorilla Monsoon was inducted by Jim Ross. Bobo Brazil was inducted by Big Cat Ernie Ladd. Arnold Skolin was inducted by Bob Backlund, who he managed when he was WWE champion. Skolin was the one who threw the towel in for Backlund to give the belt, basically, to the Iron Sheik. Chief J. Strongbow was inducted by Tatanka. Buddy Rogers was inducted by Bret the Hitman Hart. And James Dudley was inducted by Vince McMahon. Dudley, no relation to Big Dick, Bubba, Devon, or Dances with Dudley, is known for being Vince McMahon Sr.'s limo driver. But he did a little bit more than just chauffeur Vince Sr. around. It's unfair to just say he was his limo driver. He actually started working for the current Vince McMahon's grandfather, Jess McMahon. Then he got very close with Vince Sr. and worked for him for many years. Vince Sr. put him in charge of the Turner Arena in Washington, D.C., where WWE used to tape television. That made him the first African-American to run a major arena in the United States. And he was actually a hell of an athlete when he was younger. He could run a 100-yard dash in under 10 seconds. Probably would have made the Olympic team in 1924, but they would not allow him to take part because he was black. And black people were not allowed on the team. And that's how he ended up in baseball. He played in the Negro Leagues, just like Jackie Robinson did for a while. Right before he died, Vince Sr. told his son, whatever you do, take care of James Dudley. And that's what he did. He put him back on the payroll long after he had been taken off, bought him nice gifts, and put him in the Hall of Fame. If Vince McMahon did one thing, he took care of the people that his father wanted him to take care of. 25 years ago this week, on June 10th, 1996, Kevin Nash made his return to WCW as Scott Hall's big surprise on Monday Nitro to confront Eric Bischoff. This is where the big boys play, huh? Look at the adjective, play. Imagine sending your kid to a school with Kevin Nash teaching English and Scott Steiner as their math teacher. Nash wanted to know who their three guys were. They had challenged three of WCW's best. Bischoff didn't have an answer for him yet. Invited them to come on down to the Great American Bash that weekend, and he would have an answer for him then. I like how Nash in this promo threw Hogan's name out there. Just kind of throw people off. Where's Hogan? Is he off filming another episode of Blunder in Paradise? Where's Savage? Probably filming another Slim Jim commercial? Actually, you know what? They may not have even had Hogan locked down yet as the third man, now that I think about it, but it was still smart to try to throw people off if that's what they were doing. The taped Monday Night Raw that aired opposite Nitro that night narrowly beat the live Nitro in the Nielsen ratings 2.7 to 2.6, but it would be the final time that Raw would beat Nitro until April of 1998. 22 years ago this week on the June 7th, 1999 episode of Raw is War from the Fleet Center in Boston, Vince McMahon revealed himself to be the higher power, leading The Undertaker in the corporate ministry. Jim Ross's reaction to the reveal was classic, but as a viewer at the time, I can tell you, this was a massive letdown. For an entire week, actually, probably for more than a week, people were speculating who is the greater power, who's the higher power. They were speculating on it being everybody from Shawn Michaels to Jake the Snake Roberts to Ted DiBiase. But they had to go ahead and swerve everybody and make it Vince McMahon, who had turned babyface for a period of time coming out of WrestleMania 15. But there's Vince pulling down the cloak, pulling down the hood. You all bought it. Hook, line, and sinker. You all bought it. Even my immediate family bought it. Which brought out noted thespians, Linda McMahon and Stephanie McMahon. Linda reminded Vince that the family owns 4 equal shares of the company. This is before they took the company public later that year. There was a board meeting, she says, and they made a few decisions. So, on the dress code, jean shorts would now be allowed at the office. Drinking on the job is okay, which would explain a lot about the last 5 years of Monday Night Raw. Linda says, earlier today, I stepped down as the CEO, but not before handpicking my successor. At which point the glass shattered and the place came unglued. Out came Stone Cold Steve Austin wearing a t-shirt with a necktie. A very unique look. This was much better than the higher power reveal, so at least it led to something fun. Like, I get what they were trying to do here, but it was still a swerve. It felt like just to swerve people. But he made a bunch of match announcements, did Austin, including that Test, Ken Shamrock, and The Big Show, all members of the union, can have matches against anyone they want. And Test asked Stephanie McMahon to come on down to the ring and got down on one knee, and he asked her out on a date, and she accepted. So that was the start of the Test and Stephanie romance. This had Shane in the back shitting himself. Ken Shamrock said he wanted Vince McMahon in a Lion's Den match, which Vince McMahon won when Jeff Jarrett attacked Shamrock with a chair. And Big Show wanted Undertaker for the WWF title in the main event. He promised to chokeslam him straight to hell, which he did. He chokeslammed him right through the ring. 19 years ago this week, on June 10th, 2002, Stone Cold Steve Austin made one of the costliest mistakes of his career by his own admission, walking out of the Raw taping in Atlanta after Vince McMahon insisted he do the job for a young Brock Lesnar in an unannounced King of the Ring qualifying match. Austin already walked out on the company once that year, shortly after WrestleMania. He appeared on their Bite This internet show shortly before this and flat out called the creative piss poor. He was very dissatisfied with creative in the company overall, which may have been why he was booked to lose to Lesnar in the first place, to send a message. So as Vince McMahon said, he took his ball and he went home. Because of this, the entire show had to be rewritten, which today is a weekly occurrence. According to the Pro Wrestling Torch, 25% of the segments on the show that night involved Austin, who had just pinned Ric Flair on TV, with Flair being forced to become his personal assistant, so I assume that means there would have been a bunch of skits with Flair doing menial tasks for Austin. Instead, they turned Flair babyface and they booked him to lose to Vince McMahon, with McMahon regaining 100% control of the company. So that was the end of the co-owner storyline they were doing. Lesnar beat Bubba Ray Dudley instead to qualify. When Austin came back to the company the following year, McMahon fined him $250,000 for walking out. He originally fined him $650,000, but lowered it to a measly $250,000 instead. 17 years ago this week, on June 8th, 2004, Business Channel CNBC fired John Bradshaw Layfield just 3 weeks after hiring him as a guest analyst after an incident at a June 5th WWE house show in Munich, Germany. During that main event, which saw Eddie Guerrero tagging with The Undertaker against JBL and Booker T, while standing out on the apron, JBL did the old Nazi goose step and the Hitler salute as a way to get heel heat. It is illegal in Germany to do such a thing, although I think that may only be in a political context. He was not actually arrested for this, but it did cause quite a stir. It did cause CNBC to cut ties with him. In a statement, the network said CNBC has terminated its relationship with John Bradshaw Layfield. Following his conduct this past weekend in a wrestling match, we find his behavior to be offensive, inappropriate, and not befitting anyone associated with our network. Layfield told the TV column website at the time, "They hung me out to dry. I was playing a character. It's the same as Vin Diesel playing a Nazi. Despite the uproar, 3 weeks later at the Great American Bash pay-per-view, Bradshaw won the WWE Championship for the first time from Eddie Guerrero in a Texas Bull Rope match. Actually, I think that was the only time he won the WWE title, if I recall. 16 years ago this week, on June 12th, 2005, this was the other pay-per-view I referenced when I talked about two of the best pay-per-views WWE has ever produced. And it was an ECW show of all things. The first ECW one-night stand from the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. Probably the most fun that I have ever had watching a WWE pay-per-view. One of my great regrets is not buying a ticket to the actual show. It all started with the rise and fall of ECW DVD that WWE released in the fall of 2004, which did big business, way better business than they expected it to. That, coupled with Rob Van Dam prodding Vince McMahon to do a reunion show, is what led to this event taking place. Even though McMahon was not sold on it being a success, RVD asked him, "Why do you think people still chant ECW at your events?" And Vince McMahon's response was to say, "Because I've trained them to do that over the last 5 years. I did that." And he said it like he actually believed it. But ECW never got a proper ending, never got a proper send-off in 2001. It kind of died a quiet death, and so this was a way to give the fans, and probably some of the talent, closure. Too bad for RVD, though. He was recovering from knee surgery. He only could cut a promo on the show. He couldn't wrestle an actual match. There were rumors that WWE tried to bring in New Jack for the show, but he had an outstanding warrant for his arrest in New York that prevented him from being there. So very New Jack. The Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero match on this show, I remember that being a big disappointment. And I know Eddie was not happy with it at all. Those are the reports at the time. He wasn't happy about losing so soon after his heel turn. He wasn't happy about the crowd being more interested in chanting things at the WWE invaders that were up in the balcony. He just was not in a very good mood. And the match itself was not very good, and then he just up and left the building. As soon as it was over, he went to the back and he got out of there. Mike Awesome, who Joey Styles just buried 6 feet under on commentary, literally said that he wanted the man to die at one point, all because he was still salty about the way Awesome left ECW years ago. Awesome and Masato Tanaka had one of the craziest matches I've ever seen, and Awesome blew out his knee during the match as well. Tommy Dreamer and the Sandman wrestled the Dudley Boys in the main event, the last that we would see of Bubba and Devon in a WWE ring for over 10 years. Sandman came through the crowd to enter Sandman, which was edited off the DVD for obvious reasons. But if you watch this show live, that entrance was just fucking great. That was just, you talk about fun. That entire show could just be completely encapsulated in that one entrance. Fantastic. They had WWE invaders, as I mentioned, up in the balcony, just watching the show, including JBL, who got progressively more intoxicated as the show went on. On the DVD that WWE released of the pay-per-view, there is apparently an alternative commentary, or alternate, I guess you would say, commentary track, involving commentary, running commentary that JBL, I guess, you know, they were all mic'd up, so they picked up on his running commentary throughout the show. And at one point when Masato Tanaka comes out, JBL starts shouting, "That's my doorman." During the Dudley Boys match, he says, "If they make the black guy get the table, I'm going to get hot." Says, if Jerry Briscoe saw this, he'd be rolling over in his grave. And he's not even dead. On and on and on went JBL as he drank more and more. Stone Cold Steve Austin, another ECW alum, made an appearance at the end of the show, and a giant brawl broke out with the WWE and ECW names. And JBL beat the shit out of the Blue Meanie. Bloodied him up pretty good. Then a few days later, when they buried the hatchet, claimed that he didn't remember any of it. That's what he told the Meanie. He didn't remember beating him up. He didn't remember any of it. Probably because he was wasted. 15 years ago this week, on June 7th, 2006, King of the Ring 93 was not the only WWE event to take place this week in history from the Nutter Center in Dayton, Ohio. WWE aired a special on USA Network called WWE vs. ECW Head-to-Head, which featured matches between WWE stars and other WWE stars who were associated with the ECW brand, which they were getting ready to relaunch. This was basically a go-home show for the second one-night stand pay-per-view. Matches included Rob Van Dam over Rey Mysterio, Mickie James over Jazz, Big Show winning a Battle Royal, Edge beating Tommy Dreamer in an Extreme Rules match, and what a main event, the first ever meeting between John Cena and Sabu in an Extreme Rules match that ended via disqualification when Big Show broke up Cena's STF. A lame finish for what is supposed to be an Extreme Rules match. This would not be the last time that Cena and Sabu would be in the ring together. They had one more match at the Vengeance pay-per-view the following month, an Extreme Lumberjack match that Cena won. Sabu told Chris Van Vliet earlier this year that he enjoyed working with Cena. This is what he said. I liked it. I got a lot of bad information given to me about him. It was all lies and jealousy. He was a nice guy, he wasn't selfish, and he would call my spots when I forgot them. He didn't call most of the match, but when I got lost, he called it. We both called the match in the dressing room, and then we both called the match in the ring, but I would forget. He was like, do this, do that. He was always on the right page. Reminds me of the old WCW theme music for Sting. Remember Man Called Sting? He does this, he does that. Anyway, just amusing myself now. A few days later, on June 11th, WWE presented its second one-night stand pay-per-view with Rob Van Dam beating John Cena in the main event to become the new WWE champion. What an atmosphere in the Hammerstein Ballroom that night. That's where the famous "If Cena wins, we riot" sign, the whole meme, comes from. I still laugh at the fans throwing Cena's t-shirt back at his face every time he would throw it into the crowd. I do miss crowds like that. 2 days after that, on June 13th, WWE relaunched the ECW brand with a show on the Sci-Fi Network that saw the debut of The Zombie, who was promptly caned to death by the Sandman and never heard from again. This was part of Sci-Fi's edict that they wanted science fiction characters on the show. Little trivia note, The Zombie was played by the late Tim Arson, who was the first person I ever interviewed on my show. Sound Off, episode 129. Rob Van Dam was also presented with the revived ECW Championship, holding it and the WWE title at the same time. 14 years ago, on June 11, 2007, WWE held its annual draft lottery on Raw, but the big angle came at the end of the show, when Vince McMahon, on Mr. McMahon Appreciation Night no less, stepped into his limousine and it exploded with him inside. WWE reported on his death as if it were real. There were people in the building that night who called the police. People in the surrounding neighborhood who heard a loud explosion and saw a car on fire and off in the distance, they called the cops as well. Even Vince McMahon's good friend Donald Trump, the future president of the United States, was duped into thinking that Vince McMahon may actually have been blown to smithereens. Triple H appeared on the Opie and Anthony show the following year, and he was talking to Sam Roberts when he admitted that even the Donald himself called their office the next day to ask if Vince was okay. Unfortunately, it also upset their shareholders and their business partners after WWE issued a press release the very next day that read in part, "Although full details have not been disclosed, initial reports indicate that Mr. McMahon is presumed dead. An official investigation into Monday night's events is currently underway, with no one being ruled out as a suspect." 2 weeks later was to have been the funeral for Mr. McMahon on a special 3-hour edition of Raw. That was until Chris Benoit and his family were found dead that night, and the whole storyline was scrapped. 12 years ago this week, on June 13th, 2009, Japanese legend Mitsuharu Misawa died in the ring just days shy of his 47th birthday, tagging with Go Shiozaki against Bison Smith and Akitoshi Saito for the NOAH promotion that he helped form. Misawa had not been feeling well leading up to this. Saito dropped him with a back suplex, and immediately Misawa told the referee that he couldn't move, and then, just as quickly, he passed out. They didn't have doctors at ringside back then, and people realized something was very wrong when they asked over the PA system if there was a doctor in the building who could help, which there was, but there was nothing that could be done. Bison Smith, who was in the match, was on Colt Cabana's podcast in September of 2011, 2 months before he died from heart issues at 38 years old, but he said that he looked down, he saw that Misawa's face was blue, and he said what happened is that when he landed on the suplex, he snapped his neck at the base of his skull and was automatically a quadriplegic, which would explain why he told the referee he couldn't move. And then he couldn't breathe. He couldn't breathe on his own, which led to cardiac arrest, and he died. The police report had his cause of death as cervical spinal cord trauma. At the time, the Observer claimed that he shattered his C1 and C2 vertebrae, which meant that his head and his spine were no longer connected. Basically, an internal decapitation. That video is one of the saddest things that I've ever seen. You know, with all the wrestlers crowding around him while the doctors are giving him CPR in the ring and the fans are just, you know, obviously in shock and they're just in despair watching on from the crowd. Kenta was there. He's leaning in trying to see what's going on. Women in the audience are crying and shrieking. Just awful. Misawa's matches with Kawada and Kenta Kobashi, those are the ones that get talked about the most. They are as brutal as they are legendary. He wrestled a hard style, and that style, unfortunately, caught up with him. It wasn't that, you know, he died from a suplex. I mean, that's a very simplistic way of looking at it. It was years and years of abuse to his body that, unfortunately, just caught up with him. 11 years ago this week, WWE aired a special 3-hour Viewer's Choice episode of Monday Night Raw on June 7th, 2010. This was before 3-hour Raws became the norm. Although, as I said on the sound off at the time, these 3-hour Raws even then were becoming painful to sit through. Matches on the show were determined by a live fan vote. So basically Taboo Tuesday, but on a Monday. The show sucked for the first 2 hours and 45 minutes, probably. It was a terrible show, which only made the show closing angle that much more jarring. This is still one of the best angles that WWE has ever pulled off. The Nexus Invasion of Raw, which I'm sure by design very much mirrored the NWO invasion in WCW. WWE expected that Rey Mysterio was going to win the fan vote to challenge John Cena in the main event, so you'd have two babyfaces in the ring. But, surprise, surprise, CM Punk, who was a heel at the time wearing a black lucha mask, got 45% of the vote to Mysterio's 32% and 23% for Jack Swagger. I think the biggest shock is that Jack Swagger got 23%. Now I'm wondering if the vote was rigged. Although he was the World Heavyweight Champion at the time, but still. Cena was the WWE Champion. During the main event, NXT talent from season 1 of the NXT television show showed up at ringside and surrounded the ring, led by NXT season 1 winner Wade Barrett, with Daniel Bryan, David Otunga, Justin Gabriel, Michael Tarver wearing a face covering way before the CDC told him to do so. Skip Sheffield, aka Ryback, Heath Slater, and Darren Young. They proceeded to attack Cena. They attacked Punk when Punk tried to fight them off, but he couldn't. I actually like that. I like the fact that the heel came in also trying to fight these guys off. I think that added a lot of realism to it. They beat up Justin Roberts. They beat up Matt Stryker. They attacked Jerry Lawler. Then they overturned the announce desk on top of him. Michael Cole ran away. I remember thinking that maybe they were going to reveal that he orchestrated the entire thing because he was the one that got away. He got off scot-free. They destroyed the ring, they ripped up the canvas to reveal the plywood boards underneath. It was just pure chaos. It was so well done. Cena got stretchered out. Justin Roberts, in his book, Best Seat in the House, had this to say about the angle. Within a half hour of when doors were about to open, a giant black curtain was hung around the ring that blocked everybody from seeing inside. Arn Anderson was grabbing talent, mostly the newer guys from the NXT show who were still training in FCW, and bringing them behind the curtain. As I was about to leave, he looked at me and said, "You too." Maybe I needed to see how an ending was going to go down so that I can make a complicated announcement. I usually didn't like to see how things were going to end because I liked being genuinely surprised so that my reaction would make for a natural announcement. I overheard Arn say, "You'll get in the ring, Cena and everyone else, and the very last thing is, you'll get him." And he pointed at me. He has never been touched, but tonight even he is not safe. Rip his suit off and take him down. He will be the final victim before we go off the air. 4 days later, Daniel Bryan was released by WWE stemming from this angle. Stemming from his choking of Justin Roberts with his own necktie, which violated the company's PG policy of no choking. Unless, of course, you're doing a choke slam, then I guess it's okay. But it was also his spitting in John Cena's face that got him fired. On Talk is Jericho in 2014, Bryan said that when they each took turns attacking Cena, before he kicked him in the head, he spat in Cena's face. And when they got to the back, someone from WWE asked, "Who choked out Roberts with the tie?" And Bryan said, "That was me." And then someone shouted, you know, the same person, I assume, shouted, you know, "We don't choke anybody, you can't do that." And then they asked, "Who spit in Cena's face?" And Bryan said, "Well, that was me. That was me too." And they told him, "There's no spitting." And I'm thinking, what is this, public transit? There's no choking, there's no spitting on the bus. Later in the week, he spoke to Vince McMahon, who reassured him that it's all going to blow over. It's not a big deal. Everything will be fine. And then 2 days later is when Vince McMahon personally called to tell Bryan that he had to let him go. So somebody got to Vince McMahon, whether it was a sponsor or who, probably a sponsor, let's be honest. Somebody got in his ear and they had to take action, and that was the action they took. And Bryan said he didn't sound too bothered by it, he being Bryan, and he told Vince, "I'm going to go make more money than I've ever made in my life on the indie scene." And he says the comment took Vince McMahon back a little bit. He wasn't expecting that. He was probably still on a developmental deal, I assume Bryan was at the time, so I wouldn't be at all shocked that he would have made more on the indies that year than probably working for WWE. But that's where Bryan went back to. He went back to the indies until WWE brought him back 2 months later as a surprise on Team Cena against the Nexus at SummerSlam, the night the Nexus died. They had something. They really had something with that group, and they killed it. Even John Cena admitted after the match backstage to Edge and Chris Jericho that it was a mistake to bury those guys the way that he did at the end of that match. He has since, when asked, said that he comes to work and does what he's told. He's gotten over the years questions about this at like Comic-Con, WizardCon, whatever, you know, events like that. And that's his answer. He goes, "Look, I show up, I do what I'm told. I don't have the power to change the television show. I don't have the power to control who wins and loses." But he did have the power to dictate how the finish of that match went down. And if he had it to do all over again, the match would have gone very differently. 5 years ago this week, on June 8th, 2016, Andrade Cien Almas made his in-ring debut at NXT TakeOver The End with a win over Ty Dillinger. Andrade's WWE career recently reached the end. And now, you know, hey, he can recreate his TakeOver debut in AEW with Shawn Spears. The Revival, also now in AEW, I'm sensing a pattern here, reclaimed the NXT tag team titles in an excellent match against American Alpha, and Samoa Joe handed Finn Balor his first loss in the Demon Paint in a steel cage match for the NXT Championship. I don't believe that Balor has lost a match as the Demon since. I think that was the only time. And 3 years ago this week, on June 9th, 2018, New Japan Pro Wrestling hosted its Dominion show from Osaka Joe Hall, highlighted by Kenny Omega ending the 720-day reign of Kazuchika Okada to win the IWGP Championship 2-1 in a 2-out-of-3-falls match. This was the fourth and final epic between these two and one of the greatest matches that I've ever seen. For a 65-minute match, I was never bored. And Chris Jericho won the 10th Intercontinental title of his career. His first in New Japan, the other 9 came in WWE, beating Tetsuya Naito. When this event was over, both of New Japan's top champions were from Winnipeg. And I know Jericho wasn't born there, but he was raised there as a kid. Two Canadians holding the top titles in New Japan. And don't forget, at that time, as I checked the champions roll call, Young Bucks were the tag team champions, Michael Elgin was the never openweight champion, and Jay White was the United States champion. I just find that all very amusing. And that is this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the podcast and future inboxes and Q&As here on this show, thesolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send all of your questions and comments and suggestions to. Don't forget that we have one last Dark Side of the Ring review that I'm actually going to be recording as soon as I'm done here. I'm going back to back. This is on The Dark Side of the Dynamite Kid, which is very dark. I'm going to be talking about that, giving my quick review. Takeover in Your House is tonight on Peacock. And I will be live, not on Peacock, I will be live on YouTube as soon as the show is over. I hope you'll join me there. No Dynamite stream again this Wednesday because the show is preempted until Friday. But what I'm thinking about doing, and I'll let you guys know during the week on Twitter if I do this, I'm thinking, depending on how fleshed out the card is by midweek, doing a Hell in a Cell prediction stream Wednesday night in place of Dynamite. Maybe go live around 8 p.m. or so. So we might be doing that. So definitely follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I'll keep you guys posted on what I decide to do. And again, if you are a member of our YouTube channel, first of all, thank you for your support. If you're not, please consider becoming one. But if you are, you can join the Discord. It is now open exclusively to our YouTube channel members only for the time being. There is a post under the community tab. Find it from the other day. You will find the Discord link there, but I want you to leave a comment as well with your Discord handle so I can verify you and I can bring you on in. And have some fun in there. I pop in as much as I can. It'll be built up slowly but surely, but I know it's something people had asked about for a very long time, and I hope that you will join our little community in there. And I will be back with you for a new podcast, as always, next Sunday. That is Father's Day. It is Hell in a Cell Sunday, June 20th. That'll be episode 709 coming up next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a fantastic week. I will see you for the Takeover stream later tonight. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Shayna Baszler, 416 days as NXT Women's Champion, lost to a wine snob because of a possessed doll, and then went and yelled at said doll. If this is their version of a horror movie, Shayna Baszler is about to be killed off. Fire shot out of the ring post, which distracted Shayna, who was promptly rolled up and pinned. This woman gets rolled up so much, Snoop Dogg is going to start smoking her.
It's the one and only Deagle Double G.
Snoop Dogg! Snoop Dogg!
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.